Authorship of the notes. The notes, quote, breathe the nigger in every line. No white man could write notes like that. The idea of the dictating of the notes by a white man to a Negro is a joke. It is certainly the most laughable fantasy that ever was formulated by the demented brain of a human being. End quote. Leo M. Frank. James Conley said he wrote four notes at Frank's behest, but only the two near the murder victim's body were ever found. According to Conley, quote, I sat down at the table and Mr. Frank dictated the notes to me. Whatever it was, it didn't seem to suit him, and he told me to turn over and write again. And I turned the paper and wrote again. And when I done that, he told me to turn over again, and I turned over again, and wrote on the next page there. And he looked at that and kind of liked it, and he said that was all right. Then he reached over and got another piece of paper, a green piece, and told me what to write. End quote. The prosecution successfully argued that Frank waited in the factory in vain for Conley to return to help him burn the body, leaving Mary Fagan's remains for Newt Lee to discover. But two curious elements of the writing style lend credence to the suggestion that Frank may have used that Saturday afternoon to reconstruct the notes, using Conley's handwriting as a model. According to the Frank defense, the notes were written by an, quote, ignorant savage, end quote, who was, quote, besotted with liquor, end quote. But the formation of the letters and the uncannily accurate positioning of the words on each line would have been an impossible task for someone, anyone, in that state of intoxication. A recent handwriting analysis of the notes by a certified expert found, quote, normal indications of the effects of alcohol on a writer are loss of base alignment, breakdown in letter formation, and general lack of control. None of these characteristics are seen in the questioned handwriting. There are no indications of the possible effects of alcohol on the writer of the questioned notes. However, it must be noted that some writers can produce steady handwriting while under the influence of alcohol. End quote. Second, it is at best illogical that an inebriated, instinctual, and barely literate killer would have or could have thought out the need for notes, much less to have diabolically conjured up the intent that they be misconstrued as written by the dying girl herself. No one admitted to seeing Conley at the factory on the day of the murder, so he had no reason or need to explain away his presence with such notes. Frank, on the other hand, was seen by as many as a dozen people, and he was the last person to see Mary Fagan. In fact, he was the only person on that day to have spent nearly all his time on the very floor of Mary's destination, where the blood and hair evidence was found. If anybody needed notes, it was Leo Frank. One can easily imagine Frank's distress once he realized that Conley was not going to return to help him burn the body. In all likelihood, Frank rewrote the notes to his liking and entered the basement with the intention of placing a note next to the body. In the dingy basement, lit by only a gas jet, Frank probably unintentionally left an extra note. Frank lived in a world where nothing was authoritative unless it was recorded on paper, a world where invoices, reports, requisitions, purchase orders, financial sheets, and time slips gave order to his business affairs. In fact, Frank's whole business of pencil manufacturing served those who believed in the power of the written word. So, in a matter so traumatic as murder, Frank, not Conley, would have instinctually seen writing as having the ability to make sense of a frantic situation. The notes describe a specific person, night watchman Newt Lee. Quote, a long, tall, black Negro did this, end quote. And, quote, the night watch, end quote. Conley testified that he had never seen and did not know Newt Lee, and when Conley and Lee saw each other in jail, a newspaper reporter noted that no look of knowing glances passed between them. Lee said, quote, I never knew nuh saw this Jim Conley before last week in jail, end quote. Only Frank knew Newt Lee and James Conley, and only Frank knew that Lee would be on duty that night and would therefore make the perfect target to take the fall for the crime. And Frank himself may have dropped another clue. When alerted by police the morning after the murder, Frank asked, quote, "What's the trouble? Has there been a fire?" End quote. This query indicates perhaps what Frank was hoping for and expecting, that Conley had indeed returned to burn Mary Fagan's body. According to Conley, Frank told him that he would be able to gain access to the basement when he returned. And police did in fact find that the basement door had been uncustomarily unlatched from the inside. A Jewish expert on Negroes weighs in. Jewish politician and lawyer named Henry A. Alexander joined Frank's defense team for the post-conviction appeals process. He was a member of the Atlanta Jewish elite and the only Jew in the Georgia legislature during the 1909 to 1910 session. He, according to Steve Oney, quote, "had grown up with Southern blacks and was a student of their expressions and folklore," end quote. This is a generous assignment of authority, given that in the South, quote, "growing up with," end quote, the ubiquitous Southern blacks only meant that one had maids and servants. Indeed, Frank and nearly all his Jewish acquaintances were firmly ensconced in the upper middle class and thus liberally availed themselves of domestic servants. Yet this status alone uniquely qualified Alexander. In Oney's view, as the Frank team's expert forensic folklorist concerning all things, quote, "Negro," end quote. The issue requiring Alexander's particular racial, quote, "expertise," end quote, was the phrase, quote, "night witch," end quote, in one of the notes. As used in the note, it seemed intended to direct blame away from the real murderer, the note's author, to the black, quote, "night watch," end quote, or watchman, Newt Lee. And that is how the notes were at first interpreted. Investigating officer L.S. Dobbs reported, quote, "I was reading one of the notes to Lee with the following words. A tall black Negro did this. He will try to lay it on the night." And when I got to the word night, Lee says, "That means the night watchman." I had just said the night, and he said, "That means the night watchman," end quote. But Negro specialist Alexander overruled an actual Negro and insisted that, quote, "night witch," end quote, was not really referring to the, quote, "night watch," end quote, at all, but to an actual witch in, quote, "Negro superstition," end quote, somewhat akin to the universally feared boogeyman. This being so, Alexander theorized, the German-Jewish New York-reared Cornell graduate, Leo Frank, would not have known of this old Southern Negro wives' tale. Therefore, the naturally superstitious black sweeper must have concocted the murder notes and committed the crime, alone. Though Oney, in 2003, appears to have accepted the logic of that argument, there are real flaws in Alexander's theory. When Conley was asked by investigators to write the term, quote, "night watch," end quote, he wrote, quote, "night witch," end quote, the same misspelling as in the notes. Alexander's assertion that Leo Frank was ignorant of blacks and their culture ignores his family's longtime employment of black servants. Frank had resided in Atlanta since 1908 and employed many blacks in various capacities, at least 11 at the factory alone. A black woman cooked daily for Frank, his wife and her parents, and he had continual contact with her and her husband, who often did odd jobs for the Selig family. His in-laws also employed maids, servants, and a black chauffeur. Frank had far more exposure to blacks than most white Southerners. Prior to his Southern sojourn, Frank was brought up by his wealthy Southern-born parents in New York, an upbringing that very likely included black maids and servants, a common practice among Jews that extended beyond the boundaries of the South. The idea that Frank would be unfamiliar with black vernacular or folkways is incompatible with his known life experiences. Add to that the fact that common Southern culture, in the form of books, newspapers, plays, music, etc., contained the racialized tales of the Uncle Remus variety, including blackface minstrelsy and severe mockery of, quote, Negro dialect, end quote. Leo Frank thought so much of these, quote, darky tales, end quote, that he named one of the company's pencil lines the, quote, Uncle Remus, end quote, in honor of Joel Chandler Harris's beloved plantation fables. In the month preceding the murder of Mary Fagan, the Atlanta Constitution printed as pure entertainment several examples of this mockery of blacks. So ingrained were these, quote, Negro, end quote, caricatures in white Georgia culture that the blatantly racist news coverage of Frank's own trial, such as that presented here, caused no one to bat an eye. To wit, Newt, quote, Lee was not allowed to sleep. And you know what that means to a Negro. No sooner would he curl up on his bunk to dream of yellow-legged chickens, watermelons, and the fresh air of liberty, than along would come Black and Starnes, or some other member of the detective force, to harass him with questions. He told his story so often that, doubtless, if he were asked which he preferred, fried chicken or watermelon, he would say, I went down into the basement and... end quote. Britt Cragg of the Atlanta Constitution was attempting to give his readers a, quote, feel, end quote, for Newt Lee's discovery of the body, and adds an element hatched entirely from his own racist mind. Quote, something in the atmosphere of loneliness inspired him to hum the ancient strain. I got a gal into white folks' yard, brings me butter and brings me lard. Can't help but love her, so help me God. Shout, mourners, you shall be free. End quote. Blackface and coon shouting were mainstays of Jewish entertainment at the very time of the Atlanta tragedy. Quote, entertainers, end quote, like Eddie Cantor, Al Jolson, Irving Berlin, and Florenz Ziegfeld used black race mockery, quote, as a major modality, end quote. Scholar Jeffrey Melnick says that Jews played, quote, a major role in the manufacture of the racial stereotypes on which American popular culture depended. End quote. B'nai B'rith magazine printed meticulously crafted examples of what they considered, quote, Negro dialect, end quote, on several pages of their publication dedicated to, quote, jokes, end quote. Here is a B'nai B'rith, quote, joke, end quote, the Jewish editors titled Darktown. Rastus, quote, Wafo yo jeculate yourself to me in dat onery manner, end quote. Cicero, quote, Wafo, nigga, who do yo calculate yo is, end quote. Rastus, quote, Yo nigga, my family am quality folks and I'm a pussin of rank, end quote. Cicero, quote, Huh, I'll have yo triflin', Rastus, to know that I'm ranker than you is, end quote. And this titled Good Enough. Mose, quote, Dat's a pretty shirt you has on, Rastus. How many yards does it take for one ob dem shirts? End quote. Rastus, quote, What you all talking about, nigger? I done got three like them in 1 yard last night. End quote. Finally, the only explicit reference to, quote, night witches, end quote, in cultural folklore comes from, of all places, Germany, where the expression Nacht Hexen, or, quote, night witches, end quote, derives from 15th century written lore, a literature that is inseparable from Frank's and Alexander's German Jewish heritage. Norman Cohn's book on the subject is subtitled, quote, The Demonization of Christians in Medieval Christendom, end quote, and reveals that, quote, the earliest written Germanic law, the Lex Salica, treats the night witch as a reality, end quote, and that the night witch concept was, quote, traditional amongst the German peoples, end quote. This theme of German demonization of Christians certainly was widely adopted by German-American Jews and practiced by Frank and his supporters against the black, and soon against the white, Christian Gentiles. Leo Frank's attorney, Henry Nightwitch Alexander, resurfaced with yet another theory about the murder notes, this time about the source of the pads themselves. He claimed that the two notes were written on pre-printed order pads, whose numerical sequence corresponded to those stored in the basement, and not at all with those used in Frank's second-floor office. This theory fits the defense murder scenario in which Conley assaults Mary Fagan as she comes down the stairs from Frank's office and pushes her into the basement, where he alone commits the murder. Conclusive evidence was presented at the time of the trial that the company notepads were never in the basement, and that the numerical sequence was not only misrepresented, but also forged. Henry Alexander had actually altered the notepad number on the photocopy to fit his theory, though he never faced the serious charge of tampering with evidence. Frank's former office assistant, Philip Chambers, swore in an affidavit that, prior to the murder, the desk in Frank's second-floor office, along with the notepads and stationery therein, had been brought up from the basement. And per a very recent order of the fire insurance inspector, before the murder, no paper or other flammables had been stored in the basement and all trash was immediately and routinely burned. The message of the murder notes. Quote, "If people want to know who did the murder, let them study those notes. There's the secret of the murder. There's the solution. Whoever wrote those notes killed Mary Fagan. Oh, you can't get around that. It's the truth, the all-prevailing truth." End quote. Leo M. Frank. What may be the most mystifying aspect of the two murder notes is the confused complexity of the note's message. The wording was intended to appear as if the dying girl herself was writing to her mother and fingering her assailant, the Black Night Watchman. But the barely literate scribbling, Melnick says, was in, quote, "a kind of minstrel show version of African-American speech," end quote, which clashed irreconcilably with its rather sophisticated intent. It perplexed rather than fooled any of the investigators, who could recall no case where a black rapist and murderer explained his crime at the scene with pencil and paper, and to his victim's mother, no less. The phrase, quote, "that long, tall black Negro did by himself," end quote, shows that the author intended to limit culpability for the crime to a single, quote, "Negro," end quote. The term, quote, "I went to make water," end quote, a folk expression meaning to urinate, points to a specific location where the assault occurred. There was no toilet on the first floor, where Conley was stationed, but there was a toilet, the very one Mary would have used daily, on the second floor where Frank was. Despite those strange phrases, the notes do accurately foreshadow what unfolded in the months after the murder. From the outset, Leo Frank and his team insisted that Newt Lee was the murderer, even taking the unpunished extra-legal step of altering his time card and planting a bloody shirt at his home to make him the lynchable suspect. The notes, therefore, describe Frank's actual legal strategy from the moment the body was discovered to the end of his trial. In his trial testimony, Conley never actually discusses the notes' contents, only the mechanics of their creation. One suspects that Frank's cross-examining attorneys avoided pressing Conley for the details of the message, because such a course of action might have demonstrated to the jury his inability to comprehend and thus author the notes. For example, as Conley is writing the notes, he says he is unaware of their actual purpose. One of the notes appears to be addressed to the victim's mother with these words, quote, "Ma'am, that Negro hire down here did this," end quote. According to Conley, Frank told him that the notes were intended for his, Frank's, mother. Quote, "You are a good boy. I am going to send these notes to my mother in Brooklyn, New York, who is rich, and who will probably send you something," end quote. As the journal recorded it, quote, "Frank left him with the impression that an easy job with good pay awaited him with Mrs. Frank Sr. in Brooklyn," end quote. When recalling his role in writing the notes, Conley insisted one of them began with, quote, "Dear Mother," end quote. A Georgian reporter probed deeper into Conley's story. Quote, "Didn't it strike you that long, tall, black Negro would be taken to mean you?" End quote. Quote, "Yes, sir," end quote, said Conley readily. Quote, "It did, and I told Mr. Frank so. I said, look here, Mr. Frank, they're going to think that's me. But Mr. Frank said he just wanted it to send to his mother, so his mother wouldn't think he done it. And he told me he had powerful, wealthy folks in Brooklyn. That was the first time I ever heard he had rich folks up north at all. I thought they all lived here. So I wrote what he told me." End quote. Further analysis of the notes. The two notes left next to the body of Mary Fagan contain a total of 64 words, and appear to police, at first, to be part of an ill-conceived getaway scheme. But a careful analysis of the notes reveals a more calculated method in their construction. Within days of the murder, a handwriting expert for a major company, named A.M. Richardson, told an Atlanta Constitution reporter that he was, quote, "fully convinced that the Negro night watchman did not write them," end quote. Quote, "They were written by a white man, and an educated man at that. The letters are formed too expertly, and adhere too closely to the ruling of the paper on which they were written. In my opinion, they were written by the murderer, a shrewd man, with intention of reflecting guilt upon an illiterate Negro," end quote. The noted journalist, editor, and literary critic of the New York Herald Tribune, Arthur Burton Rasko, adds another layer of intrigue. Quote, "To me, the notes do not have the ring of authenticity, either as notes written by Mary Fagan or as composed by Conley, or as dictated to him by Frank. The illiteracy of them is not consistent. Words like mama, right, watch, and himself are misspelled, but the other words are spelled correctly. Hired is written higher, whereas laid, if that is the word, is correctly used and spelled. Did appears where the incorrect done would appear more likely. The use of the word Negro is an anomaly. Lower class Negroes in the South do not use it. They use the word nigga, especially in designating a Negro they wish to condemn, and in spelling the word would use some approximation of the way they pronounce it. Who, then, wrote the notes? Whoever wrote them, I think, achieved a very clumsy attempt to fake illiteracy. Why? Because if the body was to be burned by Conley, according to plan, as Conley testified, there was no point in writing the notes. If the, end quote, body, quote, was to be destroyed by cremation in the furnace, there was no reason for leaving any evidence of any kind, including a phony description of the slayer. But if Conley had failed to return after lunch, as he had promised to do, there was reason for Frank to leave such notes. Time was pressing. Frank, according to his own story to the police, was, so far as he knew, alone in the building from the time Lee came. End quote. In using a mix of inflections and misspellings of some words, the educated killer tries to feign both illiteracy and ignorance, imperfectly simulating what he believes is a, quote, "niggery," end quote, style of writing, as it was later described by one of Frank's supporters. And Leo Frank continued to drop clues leading right back to himself. In his own trial statement, he described the physical appearance of the original notes as he held them in his hand. Quote, "Now, both of those notes were written as though they had been written through a piece of carbon paper," end quote. If anyone knows the look and appearance of carbon copies, it is someone who manages a pencil factory, and whose very livelihood depends on the writing quality of its only product. Indeed, Frank's observation on that score would have to be considered expert testimony. And if the notes were written through carbon paper, as Frank himself declares, then this almost certainly excludes James Conley, for whom, as factory sweeper, carbon copying would have been an entirely alien practice. Frank's carbon copy speculation, however, not only suggests but reinforces the plausible theory that Frank used Conley's writing as a model, tracing over it, through carbon paper and onto blank paper, ostensibly to maintain the look of, quote, a Negro's, end quote, handwriting, while forming his own message. Conley testified that Frank was not satisfied with his several attempts at note writing, so Frank's revelation about the possible use of carbon paper makes the, quote, traced handwriting, end quote, theory a most likely scenario. Conley's education. Quote, if any person shall teach any slave, Negro, or free person of color to read or write, either written or printed characters, or shall procure, suffer, or permit a slave, Negro, or person of color to transact business for him in writing, such person so offending shall be guilty of a misdemeanor, and on conviction shall be punished by fine or imprisonment in the common jail or both, at the discretion of the court. End quote. Georgia State Law, enacted 1833. Quote, Conley's schooling was far better than that of most blacks of his era. End quote. Steve Oney. To Leo Frank's advocates and supporters, James Conley is a cunning, Svengali-like deceiver who gamed the entire state of Georgia by concealing his ability to read and write, thus leaving Frank as the obvious suspect. Therefore, if Conley can be shown to have writing skills, he is, ipso facto, guilty of murder. As their champion author, Steve Oney, explains, quote, Conley was not only cunning, he was literate. He could well have authored the notes discovered near Mary Fagan's body as part of a plot to pin the Fagan murder on his white boss. End quote. Oney has taken this argument further than others, and in this passage tries to confer upon Conley a veritable Rhodes scholarship. Quote, indeed, he'd been directly touched by the institutions John D. Rockefeller, Alonzo Herndon, and Henry Hugh Proctor built. In the late 1890s, Jim had attended Mitchell Street Elementary, Atlanta's best Negro public school. There, he'd been tutored by Alice Carey, Spelman, 1893, and Era Cook, Atlanta University, 1896. Mrs. Carey was Mitchell Street's principal, Miss Cook a teacher, and though they had Jim as a pupil for only 2 years, by the time he left, he could read and write. End quote. By dropping those names, resumes, and associations, Oney implies that Conley had somehow received personalized one-on-one instruction and absorbed all the knowledge gained from his, quote, tutors, end quote, in the short time he attended the segregated public elementary school. Oney continues, quote, I also found in a long overlooked piece of trial testimony the relevant fact that Conley's education was far better than that of most blacks of his era. He had been a student of two of Atlanta's most influential black educators, one a Spelman grad, the other an Atlanta University alumna. Eventually, I located a retired schoolteacher who, as a college student, had been close to Conley. End quote. Oney's source is an Atlanta Georgian article covering a part of Conley's trial testimony. The entire exchange between Luther Rosser and James Conley about his schooling is recorded as follows. Quote, Rosser, when did you go to school? Conley, before I went to work. End quote. At age 11. Quote, question, you don't know where it was? Answer, yes, it was at the Mitchell Street School. Question, who was your teacher? Answer, Miss Erin Cook. Question, who was the principal? Answer, Miss Corey. Question, what year was it? Answer, I don't know. End quote. From that brief exchange, Oney was somehow able to extrapolate that James Conley's educational experience was, quote, far better than that of most blacks of his era. End quote. Conley says that his teacher, singular, was Miss Era Cook, and that the principal, not his, quote, tutor, end quote, was Ms. Alice Carey. Conley gave direct testimony that was never impeached at the time of trial or any time thereafter. Quote, I never did go to school further than the first grade. I went to school about a year. I don't know what year it was I went to school. End quote. Inexplicably, Oney actually doubles Conley's time in school from 1 year to two. He claims that Conley attended, quote, Atlanta's best Negro public school, end quote, as if that phrase alone is not fatally problematic. Oney can muster no proof of Conley's enrollment, no attendance records, no grades or transcripts, no exam scores, no homework samples, or any other indicators of performance. In 1894, around the year Conley would have attended, it was reported that the Mitchell Street School had 442 seats, but because of extreme overcrowding, the school had to turn away 179 applicants. In its 12 years of operation, it had already had 8 principals. Each teacher in the white schools had at least 60 pupils in her overcrowded classroom. The, quote, tutoring, end quote, of any one pupil under such conditions was hardly possible. In fact, when Mary Fagan's family moved from Marietta to East Point in Atlanta, Mary could not get a desk at her overcrowded new school, so she took a job at Leo Frank's pencil factory until the start of the next school year. Most troubling is that in seeking to make Conley intellectually culpable of the murder of Mary Fagan, Oney must rewrite the history of Black American education and place himself in irreconcilable conflict with true scholars in the field, such as Paul E. Peterson, who wrote, quote, Blacks not only were educated separately from whites, they also were relegated to markedly inferior schools and were excluded altogether from secondary schooling until 1920. End quote. Oney ignores the horrid circumstances surrounding Black education in Atlanta in his quest to give Conley an advanced degree from, quote, the best Negro public school, end quote. In fact, Oney has no basis to conclude that Conley, quote, could read and write, end quote, at all. Searches of Conley's residence produced not a single writing sample by his own hand, or books, magazines, newspapers, or any literature in his home. Conley's mere 1 year in first grade suggests that his training was curtailed, as was the case for many Black children, by Jim Crow work requirements that forced Black children into their prescribed life's role as the, quote, hewers of wood and drawers of water, end quote, for white society. And there is nothing in Conley's employment history as a buggy driver, a stable hand, and a worker at a woodyard that suggests that he would have needed or used any reading or writing skill whatsoever. Even at the time of Leo Frank's trial, Conley's only known previous writing experience seems to have been the marking of boxes for Leo Frank in the pencil factory. This contrasts sharply with the findings of handwriting expert Dr. Linton Muhammad, who analyzed the murder notes in 2012 and concluded, quote, The quality of the handwriting indicates that its writer had some level of formal training in handwriting. The writer holds to the baseline and retains the left margin. End quote. In reality, Conley was able to read and write just enough to qualify him as a functional illiterate, a person whose skills in reading and writing are barely sufficient for ordinary practical needs. And in Jim Crow Atlanta in 1913, this made Jim Conley perfectly qualified to stay in his predetermined, quote, Negro, end quote, place at the bottom of white Georgian society. After making false, unsupported conclusions about Conley's education, Oney simply resorts to Rosser-like racism. Quote, Just how long Conley thought he could fool, end quote, detectives, quote, with his impersonation of a mumbling, subliterate Rastus is unknown, end quote. Through his entire exercise, Oney actually exposes one of the more insidious traits of a white supremacist. To, quote, prove, end quote, how dangerous Conley is, he must show how educated Conley is. That is precisely the mindset behind the near-maniacal white effort to keep Blacks uneducated, illiterate, and subordinate, confined to their place at the bottom of white society. W.E.B. Du Bois's axiom is confirmed. Quote, "There was one thing that the white South feared more than Negro dishonesty, ignorance, and incompetency. And that was Negro honesty, knowledge, and efficiency." End quote. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.